Father, thank you so much for your constant watch, care over us, for your constant provision, especially the provision of your word. Thank you tonight as we consider the example of Daniel for his integrity, for his care and concern for the people of God. May we learn something from that. And just pray that we could have a sense of your holiness as we see the encounters that he had with you and with the angelic realm. Pray that you would be with us tonight as we look at these things. In Christ's name, amen. Lesson number 23 in our series. And we are going to begin in chapter 10. And as it turns out, 10 through 12 form a unit. It's the longest unit in the entire book. It's basically one vision, all pulled together in three chapters. And of course, up to this point, visions have been handled one vision per chapter, right? We had 1 in 7, 1 in 8, 1 in 9. But here we got 10 through 12 kind of put together. And it's really just a lengthy vision presented in chapter 11, to which a preface, chapter 10, and a postscript have been added. So it's kind of put together that way. And chapter 10, which we're going to be looking at tonight, tells us how the vision came to Daniel. Daniel had been mourning for the trials God had shown were going to come on his people, and he sought assurance from God that they would not be destroyed by the particularly intense persecution that the last part of the preceding vision described. Remember last time we had at the end of that vision in chapter 9, we spent so much time on that last verse, but it was a discussion of what ultimately resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem, the doing away of sacrifices. And you think about somebody like Daniel, who grown up his whole life, and this was, I mean, he missed those things because they were in exile, but he wanted so much to get back. He wanted people, you know, getting back in the land now, going to rebuild the temple. And then he sees the time coming when all that seems to be done away with. This is troubling. He wants to understand, what's this all about? And in addition to the future concerns that might have been raised by the vision, there's also some immediate concerns, which we'll be talking about. This last vision was given to Daniel in the third year of the reign of Cyrus. And it was just a few years, actually, before Daniel's death. And that puts the vision about 2 years after the first group of Jewish exiles have returned to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel, the Persian-appointed governor of Judah. So, you know, Cyrus had issued a decree that the Jews could go back. Daniel had prayed, and he'd been the one to in a way, be the catalyst for that, because he saw the prophecy in Jeremiah, and he prayed, confessed the sin to the people. The prophecy about Isaiah fulfilled. Cyrus said, Jews can go back. And they didn't just all go rushing back. It was a bit of a trickle. But there was a group that went back, and they began work. And that had begun a couple of years based on when he tells us this vision occurred. This is when timing sometimes becomes important. It would have been a couple of years before he was praying and seeing his vision, because they got there probably in 536 BC. And by the autumn, they had cleared the temple area and they resumed sacrifices. Now, the temple wasn't complete. They were hoping to have a completed temple where they could do sacrifices in the actual temple, but they didn't let that delay the giving of sacrifices. And they did get the foundation for the temple laid, but then the work stopped. It stopped for 15 years until God sent Haggai, one of the minor prophets, to instruct the remnant to resume the work, which they did. And by the time Daniel received his vision, he may have heard that the work had stopped, and it might have bothered him. We're speculating over here. It doesn't say all that, but it does indicate he's mourning, he's troubled. We're trying to put together what's happening here. What's on Daniel's mind? Chapter 10 gives insight into Daniel's concern for his people and his concern for the work being done so far away in Jerusalem. He's concerned about these things. He wants to see the work of God, as he understands it, progress. And so in watching Daniel in this chapter, we learn some important lessons about prayer. And also we sort of pull back the curtain, is how I like to describe it, to get a glimpse of some of the spiritual warfare that's being waged around the work of God. As we look around us in the world, we see things happening. And we're aware of some causes that, humanly speaking, but we also know as Christians that there's a whole invisible world out there that is oftentimes interacting with, causing, being caused by the things that are happening here in the physical realm. There's an interaction that we don't get to see a lot of. We just know that it's there. And here we get just a glimpse of one situation where we actually get to pull back the curtain and see, almost like, remember in the book of Job when, you know, Job didn't know that Satan was up there in front of God, you know, making it, you know, that those invisible things that happen in the invisible realm that are having an impact, all we see is the outcome here. So we get a little bit of that here, more so next week maybe than this week. The chapter begins by saying that the message Daniel received concerned a great war, and there's a war described in great detail in chapter 11. But before this earthly war is described in chapter 11, we're given a glimpse into an earlier war that's going on in heaven. Again, there's an invisible versus visible realm going on. So we're going to read now in the NIV the first 9 verses, which we plan to cover this evening, the vision of the heavenly being. In the 3rd year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. The understanding of the message came to him in a vision. At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. I ate no choice food, no meat or wine touched my lips, and I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over. On the 24th day of the first month, I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris. I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen, with a belt of the finest gold around his waist. His body was like chrysolite, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude. I, Daniel, was the only one who saw the vision. The men with me did not see it, but such terror overwhelmed them that they fled and hid themselves. So I was left alone, gazing at this great vision. I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. And then I heard him speaking, and as I listened to him, I fell into a deep sleep, my face to the ground. Reading again in the ESV in verse 1, in the 3rd year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar. And the word was true, and it was a great conflict, and he understood the word and had understanding of the vision. So you've probably noticed by now a pattern. In each one of the 4 visions, starting in 7, then 8, then 9, here we go in 10, Daniel starts the vision by giving us a date reference. And of course, they didn't have the extensive calendar we have, you know, they would date things by years of rulers, right? We're told here that Daniel's final revelation came in the 3rd year of Cyrus, king of Persia. And if you go back and just kind of quickly review the 4 different visions, including this one, you can group them almost in 2 groups of 2. As it turns out, it's kind of a pattern here in a way. Chapter 7 was in the 1st year of Belshazzar. Daniel was 67. Chapter 8, in the 3rd year of Belshazzar, Daniel would have been about 7 years old, 550 B.C. Chapter 9, in the 1st year of Cyrus, that's 538, 537, he would have been 82. Then now this chapter 10, in the 3rd year of Cyrus, 535, 534, he was 85. So, 1st of Belshazzar, 3rd of Belshazzar, 1st of Cyrus, 3rd of Cyrus. Kind of an interesting little pattern, for what it's worth. And as I mentioned in the introduction, his 3rd year, when his last vision was received, would have been a short while after the return of the Jews coming to Palestine. And this is also about the time that the lion's den incident took place. The first 6 chapters of Daniel, which are the sort of the narrative story version that we always hear growing up in Sunday school classes or what have you, or hear about being taught in that setting, they're chronological. And then when we go to chapter 7 and we begin getting into divisions, the time scale actually jumps back to the time of Belshazzar and then kind of goes back. So it's a little bit of an overlap between those two. And so this vision occurs right around the time of the last narrative event, as it turns out. Kind of an overlay there.
I don't know if anybody's ever looked in some of the picture Bibles, but if you ever look and see about the Daniel in the lion's den, most of the pictures that I've ever seen picture him as a young man.
Yeah, and he's actually about 85.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They still picture him like he was a teenager.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing about picture Bibles. They can be, though I'm sure it's not their intention, they can be misleading. Sometimes because they just have to fill in details we're not told about. I think I've told you all before, maybe I haven't, that my son Roger, when he was younger, we were always trying to get the kids to read the Bible, and we found that we had this little picture Bible, it was like a comic book Bible, that had the whole Bible all laid out in a comic book form, like with the bubbles and the talk and all that, you know. And kids love comic books. So Roger just devoured that thing. It's like, man, this is great. I'm reading my Bible here. And so he learned that whole thing from cover to cover. And then people would bring up things about the Bible, and he would argue with them. No, it's not in the Bible. And they say, yeah, it is. And he realized that the picture Bible was different than the Bible in places. And that really frustrated him because he thought he had learned his Bible. But there's really no substitute for reading the real deal. So, so good point on the picture Bible thing there. Anyway, Daniel interjects here, interestingly enough, his name, his Babylonian name, Belteshazzar. We haven't seen that since, what, chapter 2 or 3, something like that. Apparently, he's emphasized that he's the same individual. It was earlier in the book, you know, same guy. And after all, he was 85 at this point. And it's been about 70 years since he'd been taken into captivity. 70 years. And he's still kicking. Still serving the Lord. Still being faithful. Probably his advanced years and responsibilities in Babylon kept him from making that long journey to go to... You know, you would think Daniel might be one of the first people to go back to Jerusalem. He was the one that precipitated it. He's the one that prayed for it. He's the one to see it happen. Why did he go? We're speculating, it doesn't say, but maybe because of his age and travel difficulty at that time in his life, or maybe he felt he'd be of greater service in Babylon than in Palestine. Not everybody necessarily is the best person to go. So the vision, of course, was extraordinary, as they all are, but he stressed the fact that the vision was true. Furthermore, he says, it was written in reference to a great conflict. Or ESV just says it was a great conflict, which to me isn't helpful. The NIV provides that in reference to a great conflict. I think that's the idea. This great conflict could have been a great earthly war, or it may have been a spiritual war. And really, both of these would suit the context, because we've got spiritual forces battling in chapter 10, earthly wars battling in chapter 11, as I've already pointed out. And probably all of them are recorded in these last chapters, have some kind of expression in the vision. So they're probably related to both of them, both the conflict with nations and with angels. In the final sentence of verse 1, we read, "And he understood the word and had understanding of the vision." Understanding came in answer to his prayer. He asked for understanding. And we'll get to that, not this time, but next time. And evidently he was praying for wisdom concerning the future of his people, the Jews particularly. In the previous three visions, he's already gotten a lot of information about the Jews and what's going to happen in their future, but he wants to know more, especially when he sees some of the stuff in the visions that seem concerning to him. Wait a minute, what does that mean? Why does that go that way? Now, by now, of course, the Jewish captives have returned to Palestine. Their plight was precarious. Work on the temple was being opposed by the Samaritans. And as I noted earlier, the possible reconstruction had already been halted by the time Daniel was writing this, which may have caused him some concern. So the reason they stopped is because people in the area were not happy. They were feeling threatened. And finally, the people doing the work gave in. Verse 2, in those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks, referring back to the third year of Cyrus, when he says in those days. And the mourning that takes place here is not just a one-time event, it's a continual mourning. It's a state of mourning, the way that it's structured in the grammar. And it doesn't give us the reason for his mourning. So we're speculating about some of that, which I have already done. Years later, Nehemiah mourned because what the Jews were doing in Palestine was not what it should be. And maybe, again, that's the reason Daniel's mourning. Or maybe this is the carryover. Remember in his earlier prayer, he was mourning his sin and the sin of the nation. Maybe it's a carryover from that. We're speculating because we're not told. His mourning involved prayer and it involved fasting. And we'll talk about some of that in the discussion time today. Interesting, in the Hebrew, where we just read 3 weeks, which I think that's fair, it literally says 3/7 of days. And you can almost see why they put the sevens of days instead of just 3/7, because we've just been talking about sevens of years in just the previous chapter. So to make a distinction, this is talking about days. This is real weeks, not weeks of years like we talked about just a few verses ago.
Commentaries that I was looking at about the dating there noted that from the next verse, verse 4 or so, it seems to indicate that it was around Passover.
That's coming. Yeah, I'm going to be talking about that in a minute. Yeah, that's
that could be another point.
That is.
Being able to celebrate the Passover while he's there.
Yep, you're already ahead of me, as usual. We'll get to that in just a minute. He says, I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks. So when Daniel received the revelation, he'd been fasting for 3 weeks. He said he ate no delicacies, no meat, no wine. And there's a conjunction between these two clauses, the delicacies and meat and wine, which suggests that the delicacies that were omitted were the meat and wine. Daniel seems to have been engaged in a partial fast. So he's fasting, but there's different ways to fast. You can fast from all food, maybe it's for water, and for 3 weeks, I brought up this morning the famous Three's Rule. You can only live for 3 minutes without air. You can only live for 3 days without water, and you can only live for 3 weeks without food at all. Just quick three rules so you know. So he'd been going 3 weeks, but it's a partial fast. He hasn't been abstaining from all food. He might have only been eating bread and water. We don't know beyond that. And he said, I didn't anoint myself at all, which you might wonder, what's that all about? Well, that's neglecting the usual niceties of personal grooming, such as fragrant oil on his hair or body. And anointing with body with oil was one of the common practices among the Jews and the ancient peoples. Its purpose was to soothe and refresh the skin, protect against the heat. And he was just, all his daily routines and all his normal upkeep was sort of put on hold while he focused intently on his prayer. The commentary that I was reading on this raised a few sort of application points that we'll revisit in the discussion time, but I'll lay out some of his thoughts, which I thought were worth looking at. Fasting, he says, is a neglected discipline for most Christians today, but it was commonly practiced in biblical times. Almost all the fasts in the Bible are voluntary. So fasts, as a rule, are not recorded. There's one exception that I'm aware of in the Old Testament law, the Day of Atonement. The people were commanded to deny themselves by fasting and mourning over their sins. Why do Christians fast? What would be the point of fasting? Well, through fasting, we demonstrate sincerity by denying ourselves one of humanity's strongest urges, that of satisfying physical hunger. Fasting is a personal matter. It's between us and God. It's not something that we're to make a big show of. If we choose to do it, it's not required. We don't hold each other accountable to do it, particularly. Voluntary, not required. And he makes this point. If the giants of the faith, like Moses, David, Esther, Daniel, Paul, and Jesus himself, felt the need to fast, it would seem reasonable that modern saints should be willing to deny themselves in order to pray more earnestly for the furtherance of the kingdom of God in a world that lies in deep spiritual darkness. So he throws that out there. We, again, kick that around in our discussion time about fasting. Verse 4, on the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, the first month in the Jewish year was Nisan, and it's seasonally or within the solar year, it falls in our March-April time frame. And the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar. It's built on the lunar cycles, was it 29 or 30 days? And the lunars, each of their months is a lunar month, and eventually, there's 12 of them, just like we have 12 months that are roughly 30 days. And of course, over time, those get off. So occasionally, the Jews would add in an extra month to bring the lunar cycle back into alignment with the solar cycle, just like we do with leap year. I mentioned that last time, but anyway. So he's talking about his first month of the beginning of the Jewish year, which is March and April. And he began his prayer 3 weeks before the 24th day. So if you do the math, 24 minus 3 weeks, 21 is the 3rd of Nisan. And here's Jerry's point. The Jewish Passover was celebrated on the 14th of Nisan, immediately followed by the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which lasted for 7 days. Perhaps the season of the year had been a factor in Daniel's decision to fast and pray, which is, I think, the point you were bringing up, right? Passover was a time for remembering Israel's deliverance from Egypt, and this may have turned Daniel's thought toward the present deliverance in Exodus the Israelites had from Babylon. Maybe it just brought to mind, you know, because the Jews would do this every year and think about what God had done and delivering them and thinking, hey, he's delivering us now. Maybe that was a factor in his time of prayer. Again, we're not told. These are speculations based on what we do know. Daniel was beside the great Tigris River when a heavenly being appeared to him. And for whatever reason, he was away from Babylon where he normally, that's where his residence was. He was away from that location. May have been on official business. But since he was involved in prayer and fasting, it may be that he went where he went to get away from normal business. Based on what the Tigris River goes, it starts several hundred miles north of Babylon. It gets close to Babylon at one point within about 20 miles before it heads on into the Persian Gulf. So he could have been as close as 20 miles or as far as several hundred miles, but he was not in his normal hometown when he was there. He says, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz around his waist. Behold, of course, is an interjection which expresses excitement. You know, we don't use the word too much anymore, but, you know, in the Hebrew it's like, behold. Look, behold. Daniel was amazed at this heavenly being that he's seeing. And since this heavenly being is presented in chapter 12, verse 6, as hovering in the air above the rivers of the Tigris, of the waters of the Tigris, it's probably what he's doing as Daniel sees him now. This is all kind of one vision that we're looking at between here and chapter 12. Daniel was standing on the riverbank, and so when it says he lifted up his eyes, it implies that he's hovering maybe up in the air where Daniel has to look up at him. And he's called a man because the heavenly being comes in the appearance, generally, of a man, though one dressed in a rather peculiar way. It says he was dressed in white linen garments. Now, there's a good deal of description given physically of this heavenly being. his clothing and other parts of his body. And because it's given in the text, we're going to take a look at it. Why would they be telling us these kinds of things? We're going to see if we can try to sift some of that out. We may not always be able to, but we'll see what we can come up with. Why the white linen? That's the question we're looking at now. Well, priest in Exodus and Leviticus, the angel that's talked about in Ezekiel 9, and also Revelation, were also said to be dressed in white linen garments. So there's a common denominator there. And it might not be so much the material, the linen, as it is the color, white. White was significant because it is symbolic of purity. Isaiah 1:18, though your sins be as scarlet, you shall be white as snow. The idea of purity. There's other references. And even in our modern culture, what color does the bride wear in the wedding? White, to symbolize purity. Whether it's true or not. Hopefully it's true. That's the intent. Saints in heaven are also described as wearing white robes in Revelation. And earlier in this book, God himself is described being clothed in white garments. So you begin to see this pattern, right? White, purity. What's the basic idea? The significance being clothed in linen is that this heavenly being was eminently holy. That's the conclusion I would come to. All right, what about the belt of fine gold? There were different kinds of belts they had, chain link, hinge panels, gold thread embroidery. One commentary I have, this particular one, says that he thought the linen belt was more likely. Why? Well, the linen belt, as it turns out, this golden belt was a costume of wealthy royal classes in the Near East, and we have examples of that in 1 Maccabees. So in this context, it may suggest the one wearing it was a king or judge. So now we have someone who's eminently holy and a king and or a judge. So again, putting together the characteristics with what are associated with those characteristics, we can begin to get a bit of a picture. Verse 6, his body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. The Hebrew word translated beryl occurs a number of times in the Old Testament, and it seems to be a description of a gold-colored precious stone, though some of these kinds of real specific descriptions are not, real definitely known. We have ideas about them. This may be one of those. It's been translated beryl here, crystallite, topaz, and there's an ancient writer, Pliny, who describes a transparent stone that's like, has a shininess like gold. So the idea here is a yellow-colored stone, and that would fit with the idea that his arms and legs were like the gleam of burnished bronze. What color is bronze? It's kind of a yellowy color, and if it's glowing yellow. The face of this awesome being was as brilliant as a flash of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches, and we mentioned already the arms and legs were like burnished bronze. So his whole body has this sort of fiery appearance to it, like burning metal. And then the sound of his voice, loud and full, like a crowd of people almost. It's just bringing you to a point where you're saying, this is extraordinary being that we're looking at. Who is this? I think maybe that's the point at this point. We want to know, who are we talking about here? Surprisingly, the majority of commentators identify him as an angel. Some suggest it was Gabriel. But other commentaries said it couldn't have been Gabriel. For one reason, Daniel's reaction seems to be more... Daniel normally doesn't, pass out when he sees an angel. But in this case, he does, which suggests maybe the presence of God. And on the other hand, some have identified the man dressed in linen as none other than God himself, a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ himself. And I think that's the right idea because not only the overwhelming effect that it had on Daniel, But because there are similar descriptions of God given in other places, the what we call a theophany, which is just a word that means a manifestation of God, in Ezekiel 1, and especially in Revelation 1, that vision of Christ, if you think about chapter 1, what did Christ look like in that vision? A lot of similar characteristics between what we're seeing with the man in linen here. So that would suggest this is actually a pre-incarnate appearance or manifestation of Christ. And he seems to have knowledge that the other angels don't have, and he took a divine oath in verse 7. One argument that's raised against it is when you get to verse 10, this talk about this angel in verse 10, but the description of that angel seems to be one that shows he's inferior to God. The angel was sent, for one thing, God's not sent by anybody, and he required Michael's help to fight against the angelic forces. Well, God wouldn't need help to fight against the angelic forces. So how does that fit? Well, the solution is that the man dressed in linen that we're looking at now is a different person than the angel introduced in verse 10. Two different people involved. It's not real clear about that. It's like talking about this heavenly being, and then all of a sudden we're talking about an angel, and you could almost assume it's the same, but it's not the same person. And so, as it turns out, I think there are at least four holy angels in this vision as we work our way through this. We won't cover them all today, but the interpreting angel in 10 through 14, which we won't get to today. There's Michael in 10, 13, 21. We'll get to that. And then the two others in 12. So there's a number of angels coming up in the passage. The man dressed in linen, who we do see today, is unquestionably in charge. And therefore, I would consider him to be a theophany. And the angel we see starting in verse 10 is just that, an angel. And we see a similar pattern in the book of Revelation, too. On occasion, John encounters Christ, like in chapter 1. But then later, he's being instructed by an angel. It can switch back and forth. And it seems to be the case with Daniel here. Verse 7, I, Daniel, saw the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great trembling fell upon them, and they hid themselves. So Daniel alone saw the vision. The other men who were with Daniel didn't see the vision. They only felt the supernatural presence. What are the weird circumstances? Like, how did Daniel see him? They don't. They don't see him. We're told that a great trembling overwhelmed his companions. They fled. They were so overwhelmed. And you remember Paul had a similar vision in chapter 9. Remember that? Where he could see it and hear it. And the people with him didn't so much. I think like they couldn't make out the words. It's interesting how sometimes God sets things up where one person can see more than the others. Only Daniel saw Jesus, but the others, I mean, only Paul saw Jesus, but the others felt the presence of the Lord in that passage in Acts. And same here, only Daniel saw the vision, the others didn't. All right, verse 8 and 9, we read, so I was left alone and saw this great vision. No strength was left in me. My radiant appearance was fearfully changed, and I retained no strength. Then I heard the sound of his words, and as I heard the sound of his words, I fell on my face in deep sleep with my face to the ground. So Daniel was left alone with this awesome being whose appearance drained him of all his strength. And as the heavenly person spoke, Daniel was so overwhelmed with shock that he fell on his face into a deep sleep, he says, face to the ground. And of course, that's just like the Apostle John in Revelation chapter 1, the same response in the presence of God, there in the presence clearly of Christ in Revelation 1. God spoke presumably words of greeting to Daniel, after which the prophet seems to have lapsed in a state of unconsciousness. Daniel's severe reaction to the presence of this person confirms that this being was definitely no mere angel. Well, that's where we're going to leave off at this point, because we shift into another section and we'll finish chapter 10, Lord willing, next time. But we'll go ahead and cover some discussion questions. Daniel shows a great deal of concern for his people, mourning when things are not going well for them. So that made me ask this question. In having this concern that Daniel has for the people of God in his day and people of his nation, do you think Daniel is modeling a concern that we should have in our day? It's not the exact circumstance. We're not one of the Israelites. But we have people in our nation. Should we be concerned about things that are going on in the nation? Or should we just say, you know, that's all worldly stuff, and we're just all about the gospel and the Bible, and the rest of that stuff is just, that's just for the Gentiles to worry about. Oh, okay, what about concern about people in our church? Should we be concerned about that? Or people in the church worldwide, if you want to think about the universal church. Is there something to this idea of having concern, or should we just be really focused on our Bibles, focused on God? I think the answer is obvious, but I wanted us to engage a little bit on this and think about concerns we should have, or maybe limits to concerns. You might want to place some limits on that in your mind, if you would want to do that.
Romans 9:2, Paul was had great sorrow and unceasing anguish in his heart for the people of Israel. And that's a similar way of viewing it. He was deeply moved in his anxiety of what's happening to my nation. And we ought to be concerned. But as to our nation, I'm currently giving thanks.
Yeah, I think many of us are. And, of course, we always have to acknowledge that this is a fallen world, and what's happening is short of perfection. We're not claiming that, but we can be happy when things move in a better direction, a much better direction than they were moving before. And we also know that those things can be very temporal.
Yeah.
They're here today. We hope they stay, but 4 years from now, maybe a different story. Hope not, but...
Cart presidents... just negotiated his, I think, his sixth peace treaty between two nations that we didn't have to deal with, but he chose to deal with them and serve as an agent for peace. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah.
It ought to warm our hearts. And the Armenian nation was one of those nations that few there are, but had a Christian profession from the second century on. And a huge, it had the Bible translated and the New Testament translated into their language. So it was, they are being persecuted by the Muslims, and the Muslim nation is, for the time being, now is in a treaty of peace.
Oh yeah,
it's quite an extraordinary thing.
Hmm.
And we see him trying. The same president see him trying to negotiate peace for Ukraine, the Ukraine is considered the evangelical nation of Europe, most evangelical, because there's a huge population.
87%.
Pardon me?
87% Protestant.
Yeah, it's pretty high. The Orthodox churches in submission to the Patriarch of Russia, the Russian Orthodox Church, but the Ukrainians at large are mostly Protestant, and they've had a huge increase in faith during this great struggle.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of good things there. That we ought to pray more for them.
I've heard of some individual things going on over there. I don't know how widely.
James White.
James White has had a ministry over there.
A number of times.
Even before I heard about James over there, my brother Scott, back when he was an active pastor, he went on a mission trip over there and was preaching in one of the churches, and he was stunned that they didn't just like want to hear an hour and go home. They would just keep going. He's like, man, I've never seen hunger like this. Yeah. There is hunger over here. Now, I don't know how widespread that is, but his perception was that there was quite a bit of that. And this was years ago. We're talking, a while back. But
15-minute sermon.
Yeah.
Sermon.
Yeah. No. They wanted to go on to the night, you know.
Yeah. So. A couple of hours, maybe.
Yeah.
I think we could argue that for Daniel and for Paul to be in mourning for Israel is to be in mourning for what they see as God's purposes in the world, whereas that wouldn't apply to us. But at the same time, we are told to pray for kings and those in authority, that we may live peaceful lives. He also tells Timothy, though, that a good soldier doesn't get involved in the affairs of the world. He wants to please his commanding officer. It seems like there's some both, you know, like both and. Like, don't get so wrapped up in the worldly stuff that you're all wound up about it. But do pray for it, that you might have the ability to have a peaceful life, share the gospel. That's good news.
But if you were in one of those churches in Ukraine where they've been bombed out by the Russians, and their population of 60 members have now grown to 600 members because of all the struggle, their people are turning to Christ, and you are seeing the suffering and loss of life of the families, you'd be greatly concerned about the people's nation there that you're ministering in. So, the pastor is not into politics, but he's into peace and he's into nurturing the church. And that means you're going to have to deal with a lot of suffering and sorrow. So, it's one thing not to be in politics.
One of the guys in our church this morning said, when it comes to mourning, there's always, we know so much about what's going on in the world that there's always something to be mourning about. If you want to mourn, my guess is read the news.
Yeah,
there's always something.
Get on the internet.
Yeah. But at the same time, I think we should pray for the church worldwide, but I don't think we should be mourning for people that I think we should pray for the church worldwide, but I don't mourn for people that I'm not personally involved with. You know, I know Nigeria, northern Nigeria, is having a lot of trouble. There's trouble all over the world. And if you're involved with those people, you can be very sad about it. But if you're not involved with them, I don't really want to.
Well, in a sense, Paul,
trouble,
his field of ministry was not Israel anymore.
That's true.
But he was still greatly exercised over it.
I agree with you, because I've got a friend over in Ukraine that I've been off and on contact with for many years.
Yeah.
And so that family and their well-being is, I haven't heard from them in a while. But we were in contact and sent some things to them, and then now I've been heard from them. But that kind of thing is concerning. Not the entire state of Ukraine, but them.
The people that
came. And it's just like Romania. I went there 2005 on a missions trip. So those people that I met, though I haven't been in contact with them, they're still on my heart. But country as a whole is not on my heart.
Right.
And I agree. And I think, you know, I'm not really unsure if Daniel or Paul, you know, when they say they're mourning the nation of Israel, are they mourning the entire millions of people of the nation of Israel and confessing all of those sins, or are they mourning their direct sect of people?
Well, I think what they're mourning is God's purpose in the world as it is being carried out through Israel. Paul wants to see Israel saved. Daniel wants to see Israel prosper, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're seeing Israel as God's people,
right,
and God's purposes. And even though Paul is to the Gentiles, Paul is,
because I've not heard of empathy overload.
Yeah.
And I think you can, if you stay concerned and mourn for everything, you can really just drive yourself insane.
Yeah. Dan, do you have any thoughts on this? I know you would tend to come from another side in some ways on some of this stuff, maybe, from what I know.
Well, I can see in Daniel's case just the concern for the nation, because the nation as a whole had turned.
Right.
I mean, I can see what you're saying about knowing people individually. It's hard. I mean, you know, you could be concerned about every nation of the world, and you know, so I get that point. I think in Daniel's case, to me, I've always thought of it as the whole nation. And obviously, when they went back and then they stopped building, if that was part of the reason for his mourning, it would be, again, the nation has not done what God has given them the opportunity to do.
Yeah.
So
when our nation doesn't do what God's given the opportunity to do, should we have concern about that?
Say that again?
When our nation isn't doing what God's given us the opportunity to do, should we have concern about that? And how far does that go?
Yeah.
You know,
but should we be as concerned? I mean, should we all be in like a 21-day sackcloth and ashes, fast? You know what I mean? I'm not trying to minimize it. That's what he would have been. You know? I mean, he was in a deep, you know, I was thinking of the, you know, when they have a death in the Jewish, that's what they do. I can't remember what it's called, but they black out the windows, and they, for 7 days, this is what they do. But this went beyond that. You know, is this something that we should do as a body of believers nowadays for our nation to that extent?
Well, there's two ways also to look at this, because when we talk about our nation, are we talking about the United States? Certainly we're citizens of the United States, but Daniel, in a different sense, it was a religious nation. These were the people of God. And so, I mean, you bring up a contrast here.
Mm-hmm.
The nation versus the church.
Uh-huh.
Again, I sort of expect our nation to not be, you know, honoring God, because the world system is not too concerned about truth, whereas the church in America is professing to follow God. And I'm convinced that the world actually follows the church. So if we're to be salt and light, the church is. And so if the church was salt and light, we'd really be influencing the nation. My greater concern is the professing church than the nation. Although we can pray for kings and those who are in authority. So I see Daniel, his prayer being more for the people of God than Babylon as a nation, per se. I mean, he is in Babylon for all these years, right? In a sense, that's his nation. But his real concern seems to be the Israelites, because that's the people of God.
Yeah. That was kind of the point that I was going to bring up. Under the Mosaic Covenant, which was a corporate covenant, every member of that covenant had to be obedient to God, or they would suffer the consequences of the curses of that covenant. So we see it exemplified from his, can't think of his name now. Achan. Now, one person sinned and the whole nation suffered, and the same for Daniel's time. He was still under that Mosaic covenant, which lasted until Jesus came. So there's certainly a difference. But wasn't it, Jeremiah, while they were in exile, God told him, pray for your neighboring countries, that things will go well, not just for you, but for them as well. As long as it's going well with them, it's going to be going well with you too.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to get away from the interconnectedness of some of this stuff. And you can say, that the nation is just part of the world. I mean, yes, but there's degrees in which the nation, on one hand, you got a nation that's, letting boys and girls bathrooms and pushing all the things that are such perversions today. And then there are other nations where those things are recognized as standards and upheld and honored in the society. I think it's a way better thing. And hopefully the salt and light brings that about. That's part of how it happens, how it should happen. But if it didn't matter, who would need the salt and light? Doesn't matter anyway. There's just a bunch of unbelief. Because at one time, I've kind of gone back and forth in my own life on this. And there was a time in my life I swung way over here. It's like they're just all unbelievers. No matter what they do, it's all sin to God, and he hates them all, and they're all going to hell anyway. So, I didn't have much concern about what was going on, unless they were in the church. And, now they're part of us. But that, I think it's too sharp a line. I'm just saying for myself, that I drew. I'm not saying you're there, but sometimes I hear you pulling a little more in that direction. That's why
I invited
your comment.
I'm concerned about our nation, but I think the thing that's going to change our nation is the churches. If the churches were standing strong, that's where the influence is going to come. So I'd like to see the nation do well, but I'm seeing the professing churches are not standing. So the real need I see is for the churches to come out and take a stand. And we saw what happened in COVID. They didn't. By and large, they did not come out and take a stand.
Well, there's always some that are, and a lot that aren't. And then, of course, there's always a lot of professing churches that aren't even real churches anyways, and they're, you want to count them or not. But among the true churches, I mean, there is good work being done by churches in the nation, which is part of the reason why good things do happen. It's not an all or nothing. It's not like all the churches have just all gone to...
So I listened to this. Actually, I found out today it was a CNN clip, an interview with Doug Wilson, who, as I understand it, is a good friend of James White. Am I correct on that?
Is what?
Doug Wilson and James White are good friends.
Yeah, they're on very friendly terms, yeah.
And so they were interviewing Wilson and how he was saying that he wants to see Moscow, Idaho become a Christian town, and then he wants to see the state of Idaho become a Christian state, and then the nation, that's why they planted a church in D.C., and then he wants to see the world become a Christian world, and he thinks we're... she said, well, how long do you think this is going to take? And he said, well, 250 years maybe. We're just pioneering it right now. So
he's president of the church.
He's a post-millennial.
Right. So
he's what?
He's a Presbyterian.
Yeah, he's Presbyterian.
Right.
And post-millennial probably on top of that.
He's been influencing James White. So James White's been expressing more. Of post-millennial view.
Yeah.
Right. So they would, of course, say,
right,
maybe the concern, maybe my level of concern for the nation, you would see is here, and you would see yours is here. Well, they would say, theirs is here, and you people aren't even concerned because,
Yeah, there is a broad spectrum, which is why I raised the question for us to think through it. think through our boundaries. Think, that's why I said, are there limitations? Are there areas where we should push more? And it's something that's constantly in my mind, you know, and it's something that I've shifted around on myself.
I have a question, and it may seem irrelevant, but so it looks like if Daniel is like 67 by the time Belshazzar becomes king,
mm-hmm.
did Nebuchadnezzar reign for 50 years?
Nebuchadnezzar reigned
40 something.
But he there was a with a break of 7 years.
Right.
He reigned from, what is it, 609, when he took over for his father, all the way down to 555, is that right? I'm getting my numbers. Oh, no, 655. It's 655. Yeah, 655. So it's a good 50 years, 60 or 70 years even, maybe.
But I had also read somewhere where that they may have served together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there was a 7 years when he was out of his mind.
And so the first year.
And his son may have took the reins at that time, but when he was put back in his right mind, he regained control of the nation. So he wasn't gone, and he was still king. He just wasn't in charge.
Wasn't functional.
He was just gone in the head.
He wasn't gone
physically.
He was on a journey, and he hadn't returned yet.
So well, 43 years, 605 to 562.
But that's assuming that the 7 years, that can't be in there yet, you know.
The 7 years would be in the middle of this, I would assume. Anyway, I just wondered how long, like how much influence.
It'd still be 50 years.
Oh,
it's a pretty good chunk.
All right, let me move us on to the next question. Notice Daniel doesn't just fret and mourn, he takes action. His concern for his people motivates him to pray. And of course, in the New Testament, we're told, cast our anxieties on God because he cares for us. So do your worries and concerns motivate you to pray and ask God to address your concerns? I mean, like so many questions I ask, it's an obvious answer, but again, just trying to get us to think through, not just mourning and concern, but prayer and maybe even further action beyond that.
First and Peter is a throwback to Psalm 55:22, so it's kind of a continuation really throughout Scripture. It's something that we should do regardless of our prayer. Stay in prayer and not sit in worry about things we can't change, but it should. Like it should motivate, you know, if this is a concern, it should motivate me to go to God and pray instead of worry about it on my own.
And then I've got a question for you, but really for everybody. In light of that, because I agree, you put take action, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just like we would say, we should pray for, like you brought up Romans 9, right? He was praying for his people, right? The Jewish people. But then he took action, right? So I would say it's not enough just to pray. What action should we be taking? Because I'm seeing that there's a lot of fretting, but what action is being taken? Would be my question.
Yep.
And I agree with that. And I've often wondered with that, because at what point do you, as a person, make the effort? Because, you know, you don't want to get in God's way or get ahead of God, but you also don't want to just sit idle and do nothing. So at what point does it go from waiting impatiently for God and actually being, taking that step.
And what is the step?
Right.
Yeah, and by the way, the way I've worded this, I'm actually considering prayer to be a form of taking action.
Sure, it is a form. But
it's not the only form. I'm
right.
allowing that it can extend beyond that. But,
right.
But it's at a minimum, you can do that more than you can do a lot. You can only do so many things. You can only pray so many things, I suppose. But you can oftentimes pray for a lot more than you can actually get personally involved in.
But I mean, you think of like...
give us this day our daily bread,
mm-hmm.
then what's your next action? Get a job to earn money to
right.
to buy right. your bread.
Right, Nehemiah.
So,
oh.
yeah, so otherwise, as Paul said, man won't work, let him starve.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Proverbs says his hunger moves a person to do something.
Right. So just like Nehemiah, he prayed and then he took action. Right, he went to the king and he said, "Oh, king, you know," and so certainly prayer is an action. But you know, you've been listening to a book about. It's called "Escape from Auschwitz."
I escaped from Auschwitz,
and
you did.
what really is striking to me in light of the thoughts that I've been having recently is, so this guy is captured as a teenager when he's like 17, and he is determined, I am going to escape. And he sees all these other people trying to escape, and then they make a model out of them when they catch them, because they don't escape. I mean, they get caught. And so but his goal is not simply to escape. His goal is to make the Jewish leaders aware of what's happening so that they can tell the world. Because the world doesn't know what's going on. And he escapes. Him and his friend escape, and they go to the Jewish leaders, and they're directed to this top Jewish guy, and he takes the report, but he's corrupt, and he doesn't make it known.
Mm-hmm.
And for months, nothing is happening, and 12,000 people a day are being put to death because of this corrupt religious leader. And so, no doubt he was praying, but he took action, and it was obviously. So I'm just saying, praying, yes, but what is the action we should take? In addition, because just like we would pray for lost people to be saved.
Well, that's a very individual thing. It depends on the situation, what action needs to be taken.
Yeah, it can depend on your opportunities, it can depend on your
mm-hmm.
abilities, it can depend on a number of things.
Paul preached the gospel to the Jews first and also the Gentiles. And everywhere he went, he preached to the Jews first as a foothold. He
mm-hmm.
got a foothold at that place with the gospel. To the Jews, because they were the ones who had the law, they had the knowledge of the scriptures that were then available. And he did this out of his conscience, that this was the right thing to do. But then he went on to the Gentiles. When the Jews turned their back on the gospel, he went to the Gentiles. And proceeded to build churches. So, it's not a matter of just caring, mourning and fretting. He did more than that. He put feet on his prayers.
Right.
And
he
went. And he went first to the Jews and then to the Gentiles.
Right.
So, I think evidence is... what are you doing to make sure the gospel does go in these nations?
Right.
And some people can go and some people cannot go. But those who can go ought to go if they are equipped for that mission and
right.
believe that's what God wants them to do.
Well, and I agree with what you said, Sandy. that it is an individual thing. What does God gift and equipped a person to do? And whatever your I got sidetracked with the escape, I escaped from Auschwitz because I was going to mention about Bonhoeffer. Regardless of your thought about Bonhoeffer, he was concerned and he took action. Right or wrong, that's for everyone to decide. But he took action.
Yeah,
and, and what is the saying, right? To be silent in the face of evil is itself evil. But it seems like that most people, and I'm speaking generally, don't take action. And then when someone does, they're not considered to be good. In other words, that's bad. Bonhoeffer had a lot of enemies, right? But it was oftentimes people who weren't doing anything, right? People who were covering their ears when the trains went by, as the picture is given, right? And so if someone feels like they need to take an action, then they need to take an action, right? And it doesn't matter. I mean, it's sort of like David felt like someone needs to act here. Look at this giant, right? And he was persecuted for it. But he took action, and of course we're all thankful that he took action,
yeah.
Right?
Well, let me try one more on you here. So on today's text, Daniel fasted as he prayed. In reference to Daniel's fasting, I quoted one of my commentaries. It said, fasting is a neglected discipline for most Christians today, but it was commonly practiced in biblical times. So my first question is, do you agree with the statement by the commentary that fasting is a neglected discipline for most Christians today, and that fasting was commonly practiced in biblical times?
I agree with that.
Is everybody kind of on board with that? So then I ask, have you ever fasted as a part of your prayer over something you were deeply concerned about? If so, how did that go?
Went well.
You want to tell us about it?
Didn't necessarily see immediate answer, but it was
there's
an expression.
There's no guarantees.
Right. It was an expression to the Lord, and so that's good.
Didn't you do that when you were at Lucas? You just said you weren't going to eat until you told Jesse.
I did. Yeah, that was a...
You weren't going to eat until what?
There was a... I was working for a guy, and he was the owner of the company and the boss, and I was just a programmer for him. And he was a raging unbeliever, no bones about it, made no excuses for it kind of guy. And he knew I was a Christian. I had engaged a little bit with people and him and so forth. But I just felt like I hadn't really pressed him with the gospel. And I felt like I kept putting it off. And so I made what may have been sort of a foolish vow that I was not going to eat again until I had witnessed to him. And I thought, well, boy, that was...
He didn't come into work that day.
Yeah, I mean, because I think I stayed late at the office because he used to work late every day. I used to go home on time.
He didn't come in
that day. And that wasn't part of my...
Plan.
Oh boy.
You went on a week vacation, huh?
Well, as it turns out, he was sick, I think. But he did come in after hours. And I stayed. I didn't go home. And he came in and he's like, you're still working. Because I used to go home with him. He was fine with that, you know. He didn't expect me to work long hours. He wasn't paying me that much. And I said, yeah, still working. Okay. So he was just kind of hanging out, and he said, have you had dinner yet? I said, no, not yet. He said, well, how about I take you to dinner? I said, sure. Well, now I'm on the line. I'm on the hook. Now, I wish I could tell you I witnessed to him and he accepted Christ in tears and, you know, but I did witness to him.
Before
I ate the meal, I brought it up. And he said, look, he said, I know guys like, how did he put it? Guys like you, you'll do things that angels don't fear. I don't know. He was basically saying, I know you're a devout Christian. I know where you're coming from. I understand what you're telling me. I'm not there. Thank you for your concern.
Did he feed you anyway?
He did. He fed me anyway. And I ate. I have a good conscience.
What were you going to do if he didn't show up?
I don't know. I didn't have that plan.
You could have written him a letter and mailed it. Then you witnessed to him. He just didn't get it yet.
If I'd been as clever, I would have thought of that. My brain didn't go that far. I was like, wow. I don't do things like that too much anymore, but I did then. Sometimes things like that.
It's better not to vow than to vow and not keep.
Yeah.
Ecclesiastes chapter, I think it's 5 or 6.
Well, that's actually an encouraging story, though, because you got to witness to him.
Yeah. And I don't know what he did with it ultimately. I heard he died a while back, but I don't know what state he was in or whatever. I just can only hope that something happened with it. But if not, he was
right.
I did what I should have done, mm-hmm. and I was glad for the opportunity. So it wasn't easy to do. He was not an easy guy to witness to. I promise you. That's why I felt like I had to have that kind of pressure. I just wanted to get. He just made me so uncomfortable. You know, because you could tell he did not want to hear that. He did not. So there you go. Well, that's as far as I had. Dan, you had a question that we raised while you were gone, and you wanted to bring it up.
Did you want to keep the recording on, or you want to turn it off?
Oh, yeah, I should probably turn off the recording at this point. So.